In Circle of Hope, A Reckoning with Love, Power, and Justice in an American Church, New Yorker contributor Eliza Griswold tells the illuminating story of one progressive evangelical church in Philadelphia, spanning from roughly 2019 to 2023. When Griswold first decided to immerse herself within and report on Circle of Hope, the name of the church at the center of the book, she thought she was going to be telling a story about one community, about the role of faith and religion in everyday American life, and about a different brand of evangelicalism than what many Americans think of when they hear that word. But with the events of 2020, the arrival of the COVID pandemic, and the racial reckoning and mass protests that followed the death of George Floyd, that story changed. Circle of Hope is the story. Eliza Griswold is the author of 6 books of poetry and nonfiction, including Amity and Prosperity, One Family and the Fracturing of America, which was awarded the 2019 Pulitzer Prize in General Nonfiction. She writes for The New Yorker and is the Ferris Professor and Director of the Program in Journalism at Princeton University. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Eliza Griswold to the roundtable this morning. Eliza, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I outlined it a little bit in the introduction, but what brought you the church itself on your radar?
You know, I was reporting for The New Yorker on one of its members, a really progressive evangelical superstar named Shane Claiborne. And he was undertaking the wonderful mission of melting guns into garden tools just out of the Bible to live as Jesus did and to fill out the biblical injunction of beating swords into plowshares. So it was through Shane, I was hanging out with Shane, that I met some of the members of this church and became really interested in following them.
What was it about this church that made it different within the community and in the city of Philadelphia?
I mean, these guys really walked the talk. They lived intentionally. Often they lived in kind of communes or intentional communities. They shared their paychecks. They lived in some of the hardest hit neighborhoods in Philadelphia by both the opioid crisis and just by systemic poverty. And they did all this in the name of following Jesus in the most authentic way they could. And so really living according to the tenets of the Sermon on the Mount, which is Jesus's really moral blueprint to how to be a faithful human and a good person. And so they lived these teachings in radical ways. And for me, that was really inspiring. They also are sort of funny. I mean, they are heavily tattooed, heavily pierced. They wear thrift store chic and what I call kind of modern Mennonite beards. So they have their own kind of cool. And that is fun to watch them in real time.
You have a note at the beginning of the book, and you say immersion journalism is unruly. In this case, how was it unruly, and why were you up for the ride?
It's unruly because you're essentially, like, knocking on the door of somebody's, like, somebody's driving the car of their life. And what immersion is going up and knocking on the door and saying, hey, can I get in the back of your car? And let's see where we're going. And everybody thinks they're going somewhere tidy in an hour. They're going to be, you know, they're going to be in New York City in an hour. And then 4 years later, they end up in Nevada with 3 flat tires. And so watching that process is something I'm familiar with. It's a great privilege and an honor to be able to really embed in somebody's life like that. And that is what immersion journalism is.
So when it comes to actually being there and what unfolded during your time is fascinating, because you're at a time where there, I mean, obviously there's the pandemic, which is causing fractures all over the place. And yet the story is changing very much within the church. Internal debates on the future, on diversity, are they living up to their own ideals? What was it like to sort of see that in real time start to unfold, where you have real structural damage that is happening within an organization that you went to cover of, I believe, thinking, oh, okay, here's a church that has its act together?
It was really like living our times, because yes, this is a book about a church, but it's about so much more. Almost every community I certainly know and was a part of during this time underwent really systemic questions and crises as we interrogated who we were, and as the death of George Floyd in particular and the pandemic too called into question, you know, our relationships with one another, our relationships to race and power and privilege in America. And so watching the church do this wasn't so different than watching, you know, other organizations, the Audubon Society, Time's Up. These crises happen in most progressive organizations. So that was, it was a privilege to be able to be living in such a fraught time and to kind of have a lens through which I was able to not be involved, but be able to observe what was happening in so many places.
Eliza Griswold is the author of the new book, Circle of Hope, A Reckoning with Love, Power, and Justice in an American Church. Tell us about these four pastors that you write about. These are thoughtful, earnest, young people who ultimately have different visions.
That is so well said. That's exactly who they are. They are four very committed young Christians who are, you know, the book is told through their eyes and through their stories. It never says this anywhere in the book, but I was hoping that readers would understand that we're reading principally four perspectives on one single story. And so instead of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John out of, you know, the New Testament, we're reading Johnny, Rachel, Julie, and Ben. And so we're reading people's perceptions of what's happening to them, and their perceptions are very different, although their desire to live a faithful life is all the same. And what's really painful is these guys have, for many years, they really are chosen family. Many have left behind some aspects of like their problematic childhoods and found one another and thought they were doing the right thing together, being the church, following Jesus. And when these their paths begin to diverge, it's really painful to watch because they don't do that. They don't pull apart very gracefully.
There are so many times within the book, and you talk about the various actions of the four, but they all become very tired of the arguing, right? I mean, it's not what they want to be doing.
Exactly. They do not want to be arguing. And one of the realities of the book is, you know, it tells the story of what it means to be a pastor in this day and age, which is like being a social worker, a plumber, you know, an Uber driver. Like, there's nothing that these guys don't do. They're paid almost nothing. They give their lives to the service of others in the name of God, really, in the name of serving something larger. But it is really, it's humbling. It's humbling to see how dedicated they are to their work. And it is, as I said, it's painful. It's excruciating to watch them come into conflict and begin to like drop F-bombs, shut off their Zoom screens. I mean, this is a pretty feisty bunch. This is not like, oh, let us agree to disagree. These guys are young. They believe fervently in what they're doing, and they get pretty mad at one another and disappointed with one another as their ideas of following Jesus begin to diverge.
Was it always about that, or was it ever just a power struggle of, I feel I know what's best for this organization?
It is a power struggle as well. It's a power struggle. It's a very human power struggle, which is, they don't believe they're really an organization, so it's not really like that. But it is like, who is to lead us? Who is to lead us in this time? And for one of them in particular, you know, the actual explicit effort to accrue power is actually part of mission, because as he says, you know, look, other white men can think it's not about power. They've never had to fight for it. And those of us who are like live in other bodies can tell you that, in fact, if you want power, you have to fight for it. So that's a really interesting question. And it was really a huge privilege to watch people live these power struggles.
How were the congregants a part of those struggles and of, for want of a better term, the infighting that was going on? How aware and ultimately how much a part of whether they wanted to be or not in those struggles?
That is such a great question, and no one's asked me that. The congregation, so because these churches are so anti-hierarchical, they really didn't see their congregation, they didn't put their pastors above them, right? They were as involved as anybody else. And so the congregations were very involved in the questions that the church was asking. What they weren't so engaged in, and they didn't really know about, was the nature of how bad the fighting was, right? Because they weren't privy to some of the worst of these arguments on purpose, because it wasn't that the pastors were hiding anything from them deliberately. It's that the conflict was ugly and it was painful and it was personal. And so it wasn't always clear for the pastors, as they were figuring out leadership, how informed everybody else had to be, because they weren't even sure what was going on themselves a lot of the time.
You write toward the end of the book, churches are messy places where people seek many things, among them a common understanding of something larger than they are of God. This can be a beautiful, courageous endeavor that, in its effort to do right, usually goes wrong. Maybe churches need to die to rid themselves of their old bodies, their advanced pathologies, to make themselves new again. Tell me more about that, of churches needing to die and to rid themselves of their old bodies.
Well, quite honestly, the place that I took that from is from the life cycle of rivers, right? Like, rivers die in that the rivers age. Rivers, as rivers age, they grow wigglier and wavier in their beds. They develop what are called oxbow lakes, right? And those lakes get cut off from the main flow of the river. Everything slows down and gets pretty muddy. And when a river is new or young, it really cuts itself straight again. And so the life cycle of a river is kind of what I was envisioning here. It's not like death with a capital D, because in Christianity, there is no death with a capital D. I mean, that is in the same section, the idea that for many Christians, that the cycle of death and rebirth, which is built into the liturgical year, right? You have Jesus die, you have Jesus born on Christmas Day, through the cycle of Jesus dying on Good Friday, just before Easter and the rebirth. So death and rebirth is built into Christianity, which is supposedly supposed to take some of the fear out of death. I think that churches that are willing, to die, and Jesus certainly talks about taking up the cross and dying to self, that often the process of death is about shedding ego and shedding the kind of crunchier parts of woundedness that need to be let go of.
My final question is probably the hardest, which is coming into this knowing, I assume having a feeling for what obviously you're entering, were there fundamental changes in thoughts about how you felt about religion, the role of religion, and your own spirituality?
There was a profound disappointment that I lived alongside these folks, because I, in many ways, believe, and I still think, that what they were after, this kind of ardent devotion that really possesses creative imagination to how to follow Jesus in 2024. What does that look like? How willing am I to sacrifice myself to give to this greater cause? I think that's inspiring and admirable. So to watch it lived out and not go in that direction was disappointing. For me, I am not a churchgoer. I am sociologically a churchgoer. I'm a pastor's kid. So I've spent a lot of time in church. But I didn't grow up in a church that thought believing in Jesus was any better than believing in the Buddha, or Like, it didn't privilege Christianity as any kind of one true way to anything, which left me open to any kind of seeking what Paul Tillich might call ultimate concern or God, right? So I live in a roomier space in which belief is really a practice. Belief isn't the right word. Seeking is the right word, and that's an active practice. So for me, this helped me continue on that path, because I do this work out of, like, honestly, a sense of vocation. Like, I really do feel like a translator here, that translating worlds of meaning to readers who are seeking meaning. That's pretty true. So that is my spiritual life kind of in action in this book. And I hope that answers your good question.
It does answer my question. It does lead, however, to another question. So I lied when I said that was my last question, which is, immersing yourself in this world, and we talked about this at the beginning, is one thing. What is it like to extract yourself from it?
What is it like to extract myself?
Yes.
You are a very good interviewer. What is it like to extract myself? You know, I was really worried about how the people in the church would feel about this book, because I was worried that they hurt each other pretty badly, and I was worried that this book might hurt them more. And there are people who don't like it and who feel betrayed, but it's not clear whether they feel betrayed by the book or by the process they went through. And I'm not sure they're clear on that. And that's a tiny number. What's shocking to me is the overwhelming love and gratitude I have received from members of this church for this book. They love it, and they come to my events and they post about it on social media. And that, to me, that really matters. I don't read reviews. I just don't, because I just don't need people's thoughts on anything in my head. The book is done. I can't do anything about it. But I do read their reader. Like, they write on Goodreads. They write on Amazon. And I'm like, holy cow. Like, this makes me feel not only that the project was worthwhile, but that I did it with as much compassion as I intended to. And that feels pretty good. So that's the process of extracting myself. Like, I don't think about the book as the book. I'm done. It's done. I did my best. But thinking about how it's received and having that be a positive has been meant more to me than I could have known.
Eliza Griswold is the author of Circle of Hope, A Reckoning with Love, Power, and Justice in an American Church. It is published by FSG. Thank you so much for being with us, Eliza. Great pleasure to have you on the program.
Pleasure was mine. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Be well. Again, the name of the book is Circle of Hope. Eliza Griswold is the author of the Pulitzer Prize winning Amity and Prosperity. She writes for The New Yorker and is the Ferris Professor and Director of the Program in Journalism at Princeton University. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.